UK Wine Show, show number 130. Jancis Robinson on wine writing. On this week's award-winning wine show, we're talking with Jancis Robinson about wine writing and the World Atlas of Wine. In the spotlight, we start looking at a yeast.
And in the news, fine wine slowdown, Campo Viejo gets £1 million spend, and Chinese oak barrels that are made in Spain.
G'day, welcome to the UK Wine Show, show number 130 for the 7th of November 2008. My name's Chris Scott, and on this week's show we're talking with wine writer Jancis Robinson. Jancis is probably the foremost wine writer in the UK, and we talked to her about wine writing and how long does it take to write a tome like the Oxford Companion to Wine. In the spotlight, we've finished off looking at soils, and this week we're going to be looking at something most people don't normally think about when they're talking about wine, but can change the wine significantly. So we're going to be fermenting on yeast. And the quote this week is, "In victory, you deserve champagne. In defeat, you need it." Who said that? Clues throughout the show? Answer at the end. But next up, we have the news with Jane.
Thanks, Chris. A Spanish cooper in Rioja is making barrels out of Chinese oak to supply winemakers in the region, including Miguel Torres, for use in trials. The Rioja cooperage, Tonelaria Magrenan, joined forces 3 years ago with a Chinese partner to import the wood, which is sourced from a forest in Mongolia. They bought about 40,000 barrels worth of standing trees, cured the oak, and aged it for 36 months until ready for use this year. Miguel Torres say the wine aged in Chinese oak had a good aromatic and fruit intensity with some fine toast notes and vanilla and coconut, similar to American oak, but less complex on the palate versus French oak. And the good news is that the price of Chinese oak is about 5 to 10% lower than French.
There's no reason Chinese oak cannot be as good as other oak from other regions of the world. This oak is from Mongolia, which is cool, so you expect tight-grained wood, but the other properties I'm unsure of. If you want a great look at the different types of oak and their effects, you can get them from a spotlight series we covered a wee while ago at ukwineshow.co.uk. Under the hot topics on the left-hand side, there's a link to oak barrels in the article. What's next, Jane?
Well, it was only a few weeks ago that we reported that fine wine auctions were holding up against a possible recession. But it's now looking like the market is slowing down, with sales at US auctions starting to drop. Normally 80 to 100% of lots are sold, but in two recent auctions in New York, at Christie's and Sotheby's, only 67 and 70% of lots found buyers. Revenues and lot prices at wine auctions around the world are falling substantially, suggesting the onset of a buyer's market. We also reported on the rise of pub closures in the UK, but it's good news for pub chain JD Wetherspoon, who has announced like-for-like sales increase of 1.5% for the 13 weeks to 26th of October. As they say, hard times mean good times. In Britain, that means heading to the pub.
You're right, Jane. It was only a couple of weeks ago we were talking about the auction prices holding up. Personally, I didn't put much hope in that. Fine wines are a bit like pieces of art. They go up in the boom times and down in the recessions. Falling prices hasn't stopped Pernod Ricard. What's going on there, Jane?
Yes, keep an eye out for Campo Viejo of Rioja, with an advertising campaign coming your way soon. Campo Viejo is owned by Pernod Ricard, the world's second biggest wine company, and is being promoted with a £1 million ad campaign in London and South East England. Ads will run at train and tube stations and on 33 London taxis, as well as online on the Times, Telegraph and Guardian websites. The Campo Viejo brand has been growing at 14% in volume and 15% by value, and Pernod Ricard say Campo Viejo is a strategic priority for them in building brands that will succeed in the long term. That's all from me this week, but don't forget you can get these stories at our website 3050.co.uk.
Cheers, Jane. Campo Viejo is a Spanish brand, but the person in this week's quote was French. The quote, if you recall, is, "In victory, you deserve champagne. In defeat, you need it." Well, we're talking about a military man who savoured both victory and defeat. And with his defeat, he would have marched all across Europe's terroir. Bad joke there. This week we move on in our search for terroir and we start looking at the winemaker's influence. The winemaker can influence wine in a number of ways, with some proponents of terroir believing that the winemaker should be secondary to all other aspects of terroir. These proponents, while advocating that the vineyard speaks for itself, will still significantly change the wine by putting it into an oak barrel. Like many things in the wine industry, there are many corners fiercely defended with their point of view. In this section, we're going to be looking at the different decisions that a winemaker makes and how it influences the wines. We begin this week by looking at wine yeast. Yeast is a single-celled organism through its own metabolic processes converts carbohydrates to alcohol and acids. To be precise, there are two common forms of fermentation in wine. One is to convert the sugar into alcohol, known as the alcoholic fermentation, or simply put, fermentation most times. The other fermentation for wine is converting the sharp malic acid, think green apples, into a softer tasting lactic acid, think milk. Known commonly as malolactic fermentation. Unlike alcoholic fermentation that uses yeasts, malolactic fermentation occurs through lactic acid bacteria, and we'll be looking at covering this later on. The yeast species Saccharomyces cerevisiae, used in alcoholic fermentation, has been used in baking and fermenting wine and beers for thousands of years. It's been used in food and wine to enrich diet by developing of flavors, aromas, improve texture, add proteins, amino acids, fatty acids, and vitamins. But perhaps the most useful for wine is the preservation through the development of alcohol. Different types of Saccharomyces cerevisiae can change the flavor, aroma, texture, and structure of the wine. It is no wonder then that traditionalists believe that inoculating a wine by introducing foreign strains of yeast into the winery is a break from terroir. It is true that wines with a range of yeast, which is common in wild fermentation, i.e. not inoculated or introduced yeasts, just using what's around naturally, will produce a larger range of flavors compared to inoculated wines. The question is, does the lack of control and associated problems of using wild yeast outweigh the benefit of having an individual wine? These wild fermentations are not as wild as many people believe. If a winery nearby starts using a particular yeast strain, it is likely that the yeast will eventually make its way into the neighbor's wild fermentation. After all, yeasts are airborne and mobile. Given there is yeast everywhere, why inoculate wines? Put simply, it creates a more reliable, repeatable wine, often fermenting faster with less problems. When you inoculate a wine with yeast, you introduce a huge population of yeast at the very beginning of the wine. And while there may be wild yeast in the juice, the population of wild yeast never have a chance to compete with this huge population of inoculated yeasts. Wild fermentations are a bit of an arms race between yeast species, with some yeasts better adapted at the beginning of a fermentation when there's low alcohol and more nutrients about, compared to, say, the middle where there's lower nitrogen and higher alcohol. Either way, there is no guaranteeing that the wild yeast that lands up dominating the fermentation will be suitable at higher alcohol levels and towards the end of the fermentation. This often results in stuck fermentation. With yeast, it can often be helpful to think of a population of yeast having momentum during fermentation. With enough momentum, a yeast that isn't suitable for high alcohol levels could, in fact, complete fermentation on a reasonably high level of alcohol. But occasionally a population will die out before fermentation is complete. This could be due to temperature, alcohol levels, or even a nutrient deficiency. Stuck fermentations may need an inoculated yeast that can cope with the specific problem. Now, many New World producers are moving to these wild fermentations, as seen in Burgundy, Bordeaux, and Italy. This is a risky strategy, as they haven't had the hundreds of years of building up enormous populations of wild yeast strains that are suitable for grapes and winemaking. That said, inoculated yeasts are just simply selected from famous wine regions of the world. That ends this week's look at yeast. I bet you never thought that was so exciting. Next week, we're actually going to be looking at how the flavors can change and the texture of the wine can change with different types of yeasts. Yeast not only affects grape juice, it can be a soldier's nightmare as well. Yeast infections in your feet is not a good thing. And the person in our quote this week may not have had any yeast problems with his soldiers, but it was his soldiers who first recorded trench foot in 1812. However, our general had his own problems and was either poisoned or died of cancer. There's much discussion about this. While our mystery man has had many books written about him and has influenced the wine industry in his own way, the influence that Jancis Robinson has had on the wine industry with her authoritative Oxford Companion and her work on the World Atlas of Wine, she wrote in conjunction with Hugh Johnson, are both excellent reference books. Next up, we're going to be talking with Jancis about wine writing. We catch up on her history and find out about the book she would love to write next. Let's have a listen to what Jancis has to say. Hi, I'm here with Jancis Robinson, a wine writer. We're going to be talking about wine books today. How are you?
I am very well, thanks, Chris.
Excellent. You've produced quite a few books. Probably the two most recent ones are your Oxford Companion.
The third edition.
The third edition of the Oxford Companion.
That came out in 2006.
And then we've got the World Atlas of Wine you did with Hugh Johnson.
And that the sixth edition of that came out late in 2007.
That's right. The World Atlas of Wine, that was originally Hugh's...
Hugh brought out the first edition in 1971.
That was the year I was born.
Ah. And then when the time came to do the fifth edition, he sidled up to me at a party and said, I'd need some help on this. Can't face doing another one of these all by myself. How do you feel about that? And I was very flattered to be asked because... I think, like most wine writers, I've had the World Atlas of Wine by my side throughout my career. Mm. But especially having already produced two editions of the Oxford Companion to Wine, I was under no illusions about how much work would have been involved. And also, I think perhaps the Atlas was due for a good old wash and brush up, particularly the introductory chapters and stuff like that. So I knew I wouldn't be able to resist doing a real spring clean of the whole thing.
Yeah.
But after... a couple of months, said, oh, all right then. So rose to that challenge. And so myself and my wonderful assistant, Julia Harding, MW, have been very closely involved in the fifth and now sixth editions of the World Atlas of Wine.
How does the writing process take? Because you've got the initial book you had. Is it just a case of reading through and updating the out-of-date stuff, or is it more like, where do we start?
Sometimes... things have moved on so much, you've just got to start again. So it'll be interesting, actually, doing this seventh edition to see how we feel about that. And sometimes you just have to drop a place that has become less important, actually. I remember with the fifth edition, I think Hugh had a whole page on the Castelli Romani. You know, Frascati really being the wine that's produced there. And I think Hugh must have gone and just had a lovely lunch there once or something, because his writing is so brilliant. And so it's the whole page, you know, was all around what a beautiful part of the world it was. And it is, although Rome is sort of encroaching on it. But I just could, in a place where, you know, New Zealand had only a handful of pages, you just couldn't justify giving Castelli Romani and Frascati a whole page themselves. So that, for instance, was dropped from the fifth. I'd say perhaps the most... crucial meetings we have are at the very beginning of a new edition, where we all sit round and decide which new pages need to be added, which new maps, what if anything has to be dropped.
The maps themselves, this is actually I used to have another wine atlas, I can't remember the name of it actually, but
there's the Sotheby's one, which and Oz does one.
Yeah, I can't remember. Yeah. But the maps on the sixth edition, just really impressed with the maps.
Oh, good. Well, they've digitized them and put a lot of money and work into them.
Yeah, you've got contours, you've got vineyards, you can see orientations. You know, you can really start to understand what's going on with the maps, which I really like. Who did your maps?
They start off with us and we present the raw material. Obviously, Hugh did the oldest one. I mean, Hugh must have done a huge amount of work getting all those Burgundy maps, for instance, and the bare bones of the Bordeaux maps and things like that. But if it's a new region, then you start off with, you know... Yes, and then you sort of superimpose what you say has to go on and things like that.
Yeah, quite a bit of work, though.
Oh, yes. And it's a completely different discipline from writing text as well. And your eye has to work in a completely different way.
One of the things about the World Wine Atlas I found quite
difficult. I reviewed it. I gave it a slightly negative mark for.
Fair enough. We've sold the odd copy despite that.
Yeah, so. Yeah, I'm sure it doesn't matter. Is referencing. I found it quite hard looking for particular information on a page.
Do you mean on the map or in text?
No, in text. You do have stuff that's highlighted, bold.
Yeah.
But often the bit that I was looking for wasn't in bold and there wasn't a lot of headings. It was more...
Right, fair comment. I know in the sixth edition we have tried to put more bolding in. We can't afford to have subheadings because we're just so short of space. That just takes up too much space. If we have a two-line gap for a heading saying... Omedoc, or I don't know,
whatever,
Bly or something. We've lost, you know, two lines worth of words, and we fight over those words all the time. You wouldn't believe it. But I suggested that where we had a spread that was about several different places, then we put the first mention of that place in bold, wherever possible. So maybe we're just not doing that enough. But I will think of you when we're planning the seventh edition, and I'll try and do that more. And, of course, what you can do now with those... there's always been an index and a gazetteer at the back. So if you're looking up something on a map, you can find the map reference for it. But now, on my website, if you're a subscriber, you can just key in that word and it takes you straight to the map.
Oh, you've got the maps, that's right, but not the text. So.
That's right.
Yeah. Okay, I think we're subscriber purple pages. Well, I think we share it. I don't know if this is legal. We share it between a few of us.
That's not at all legal. In fact, if you read the terms and conditions, you'd find that you should be in prison by now. Dear.
Yeah, well, never mind. So your other book was the Oxford Companion. You started that yourself with Oxford Publishing?
Oxford have a series called The Oxford Companion 2, which started in the 1930s with English literature. And I thought it was a great compliment to wine in a way when they decided they wanted to have one to wine. Mm-hmm. And they approached me in the late 80s. And as an Oxford graduate, I was kind of thinking, yes, well, that's a nice compliment to me that they want me to do that. Yeah. But absolutely terrifying because they wanted a book that was almost 1 million words long, of which not a single one existed. So for 5 years, I woke up in the middle of each night thinking, how on earth am I going to fill those pages? Really? Yeah, it was 5 years solid work.
Sheesh. How long does it take to review it now?
Revise it about, well, it takes both me and Julia about 2 years. So that's 4 woman years. And we do, we
5
really,
man years.
We, yes, exactly. 6. But we do take our revision duties very seriously. I'm afraid it's a regrettable tendency in publishers to think, slap a new jacket on something, call it the N plus 1th edition and people will buy it. Yeah, but both Julia and I and Hugh, we're all from publishing backgrounds and we really do want to give people something that is thoroughly up to date and we can hold our heads up high and say we've gone through every single comma. So we really do that.
The Oxford Companion, quite a very, very, very...
Very detailed.
I tell you what.
Very heavy.
Keeps the door open at night.
Yes, exactly. You don't want to take it to bed with you.
Certainly not. Well, yeah... Probably not, no. Why did you take on a 5-year project? Did you know it was a 5-year project?
Well, the timing wasn't bad. It was sort of just as Nick had sold his restaurant.
That's your husband, Nick.
Yeah. And I think there were, we'd had the big brash loads of money 80s. And I think, and I'd been on television, I'd been doing these 3 series of the wine programme. But I think I almost sensed that there were sort of some leaner times ahead. And I also had our last child in 91. The book came out in 94. And it was actually a very good project for staying at home and sort of slightly, you know, pulling up the drawbridge and just sitting at the desk and doing something completely different from this zooming around the world filming television series and things like that. And I think, in a way... there are all sorts of things that I'm not very good at, and I would never, ever claim to be brilliant at lots of things. But I do think it's not a bad match between me and that book. I think I sort of got the tone that it had to be, and the reasonably academic, i.e. not too dull, but pretty authoritative. and the reasonably academic bent of it. And the way, what I really enjoy about the Oxford Companion is that it's multidisciplinary. So I was able to ask some of the top historians in their fields, for instance, to write essays on topics related to wine. I mean, you know, you would talk to the expert on Romans and he would history of whenever, and he would write the brilliant thing on symposia, you know, or an archaeologist or scientists who are absolutely up to the minute with developments in particular fields, and get them to present you with that little bit of their special subject that was relevant to wine lovers. And then I was a lot of pretty heavy editing, as you can imagine, because, yeah, you know, there are hundreds of different contributors there, and yet the tone has to be consistent, more or less the same throughout. So it was a project which I, although it was terrifying, I enjoyed it as well. And, of course, for a control freak, it's brilliant, because I was in control. Freak? Yep.
Okay.
Absolutely. But imagine this, putting together the Oxford Companion to Wine before email existed. And all the contributions came in on paper.
Oh, lovely.
Lovely. Had to be keyed in. Yeah.
Oh, brilliant. Yeah, no, that's excellent. Excellent. You've got, now that you're involved with Hugh and the Atlas, and you've got the Companion, that seems to be the two main styles of wine books, really, isn't it? You've got a very authoritative reference book. You've got a very on everything to do with wine. You've got a very authoritative on the wines themselves. Is there another style of book that we've been missing that you've itching to get out?
Well, I haven't got time. I mean, the book I want to do a completely new version of, which I really enjoyed doing, and you probably haven't even seen, was published in 1986 when you were, I hope, not drinking wine. And
Not wine, beer.
Yes. And it was called Vines, Grapes and Wines. And it was the first book splitting up the wine world by grape variety. And it was really quite groundbreaking at the time. It sold very well in France, actually, Le Livre des Cépages, at a time when cépage was seen as a dirty word by a lot of French wine producers. And that desperately needs updating because, you know, it was written coming up for 20 years ago, sorry. And so much has changed since then. And it would be fun to do that again. But it's just so difficult to find the time because in between updating the Atlas and the Companion and keeping, you know, my articles and my website up to date, it's very, very difficult to see how to fit another book in. I do have several thoughts for other books that I would really like to do, but it's a time thing.
Yep. You haven't seen yourself writing any fiction-y type material?
I have no imagination, Chris, so I couldn't possibly do that. But I did enjoy writing. Somebody wanted me to write a professional memoir. It's called, in England, it's called Confessions of a Wine Lover. In America, it's called Tasting Pleasure. And it's my reminiscences of my life in wine up to its year of publication, which I think was 1997. And that was lovely, because that's a reading book as opposed to a reference book. Yeah, and I really enjoyed that.
Because a lot of your work is reference book related, isn't it?
You're right. You've noticed.
Yeah. and reference books, you know, I like reference books, but they're not...
They're not a good read. No. Well, that's why I suppose I enjoy writing articles. I love writing about people. And, no, I would be very sad if I didn't have an outlet for slightly more discursive writing.
Mm. You've mentioned you've got an assistant who helps you out, Julia Harding. How does that relationship work? And, you know, you don't see...
By email.
you don't see her name on the books either. Is she doing a lot of research?
Oh, you do. She is the assistant editor. She's down on the front page as the assistant editor of the Oxford Companion to Wine.
Uh-huh.
And she's there on the inside, the Atlas, yeah. Julia was fantastic. She really took charge of the map side of things on the World Atlas, which was wonderful.
You said you communicate by email. How does that relationship work? Is it, you know, employee employer? Is it very much a team orientated, or is it she works for you one day a week, but she does her own things?
She's a full time employee. She came to see me.
Jesus Robin LTD.
Yes. She came to see me about 7 years ago, saying when she'd just got the wine bug and she'd been a publisher's editor, saying she wanted to work for me. And I said, "You've got to be joking. I'm such a control freak. I'll never have anybody working for me." And then she just sort of slowly kept going, coming, saying, you know, I really do want to work for you. No, honestly, I do want to work for you. And then when she came top, she passed the Master of Wine exams first go and came top. I said, oh, all right then, you can work for me.
Excellent.
And she's brilliant. She's very, very good and extremely conscientious and talented. Speaks perfect French and German. Tastes very well. Tastes very similarly to me, anyway. Mm. And is a real details person. So it's great. I'm very lucky.
Okay then, Jensis. I think we'll wrap it up there. Thank you very much for your time.
Great.
Jensis is a prodigious writer, and the time taken to write and rewrite the Oxford Companion is huge. I have reviewed her book with Hugh Johnson, and if you want to have a look at that, you can get that from our website, ukwineshow.co.uk. It's under book reviews. Next week, we're going to be talking to Chris Unger about wine and the environment. So that's something to look forward to. Before we close up, I'm looking for some feedback from you guys on the spotlights, book reviews, and technical stuff, and how you're enjoying the quotes. To chris.scott@3050.co.uk. That's chris.scott@3050.co.uk. But talking about the quote, let's finish up with it. The quote, if you recall, is, "In victory, you deserve champagne. In defeat, you need it." Our general lived between 1769 and 1821, and we've actually already had a quote from him, so he may be fresh in your mind. It is, of course, Napoleon. Until next week, cheers and good drinking.
The UK Wine Show is a weekly podcast brought to you by 3050, the wine tasting company. The show is produced by Chris Scott and the news is read by Jane Scott. To listen to other shows, visit ukwineshow.co.uk. Thank you for listening.